Ignition sequence start.
See, Elijah Wan has David Robinson just bamboozled.
Kelly out of the corner for three, hit it!
Don't ever underestimate the heart of a champion.
The Houston Rockets select Yao Ming.
McGrady at the buzzer.
Yes! Paul touch it up!
Thompson steps right, shoots for the win, a three, he got it!
I know what we need to do. I know exactly what we need to do.
Russell Westbrook.
James Harden.
I know what's at stake.
It's going to be scary. Not for us.
What's up, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast home for everything Houston Rockets basketball. I'm your host, Jackson Gatlin, at JT Gatlin on Twitter. Producer with Sports Talk 790, the team's official radio flagship here in Houston. Regrettably, we got to talk about this 116-104 loss against the Golden State Warriors on Christmas Day, no less. It's as if the Rockets took a lump of coal and just collectively divvied it amongst all of our stockings. It's kind of how this game felt. It felt bad for a bunch of different reasons. It feels bad because it's the Golden State Warriors, and you'd obviously love to beat them, even though it's not the same Golden State Warriors. It's still the Warriors. It's still Steve Kerr. It's still Draymond out there. It's still Steph Curry and Klay Thompson yucking it up over on the bench. You still want to beat the Warriors. That rivalry's still there, and it'll probably be there for a long time. James Harden was still being booed in that arena. That hatred runs deep. It sucks because it was on national TV, and it was a chance for the Rockets to come out and really put on a show in front of the national audience, get some of the less integrated fans involved in the type of play that can be expected from James Harden and Russell Westbrook, the type of play that we've been seeing on a pretty consistent basis over the last, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 games. But instead, they didn't come out with... They actually didn't come out of the gate too poorly. I mean, all things considered, that first quarter, really the first half, up until they let the Warriors kind of go on that run to kill all the momentum headed into halftime, the game didn't look bad by any means. James was heating up in the second quarter after, you know, only attempting one shot in the first quarter. It looked like things were going to be blown wide open. And Rockets at one point in the second quarter had a 13-point lead on the Warriors, 53-40. And instead, they go on a ridiculous run to close out the half, and we start the second half 68-64. You start with just a 4-point lead because this team doesn't know how to hold on to a lead. This team can't, and to be fair, in the NBA today, it's really hard to hold on to a lead. No lead is safe. We say that all the time, and it stands true, but still, when the momentum starts to shift like that, that's when you'd like to see this team key in and be like, all right, guys, we got the lead, but we got to still, you know, keep our cool on defense. Or you'd like to see Mike D'Antoni take a timeout before he starts to see the lead evaporate. Or just anything, you know, maybe a subtle change in the lineup. Maybe once you get the lead, you sub in your defensive-minded lineup so that you can maybe maintain the lead. But those things didn't happen, unfortunately. This loss is... Again, no loss is world-ending, and no win is monumental, hey, let's go start hanging the banners right now. I think that's one thing that gets kind of, maybe not lost in translation, but I think that's one thing that fans tend to struggle with is, you know, you look at these games and, you know, you experience the mountainous highs when you have a really good win, and then you also experience the frustrating lows. That's part of being a sports fan, and that's part of the journey. You know, you invest yourself so emotionally into these teams. And I want you guys all to know that I'm right there with you. I'm a fan of this team through and through. So when you guys are frustrated, I'm frustrated. When you guys are happy, I'm happy. But at the same time, I think that it becomes a slightly more enjoyable experience when you do tone back the emotions a bit and you try to look at things a little bit more objectively. Because, again, even after the Rockets beat the Clippers last week, you know, I wasn't in here clamoring saying that the Rockets are going to be 2020 NBA champions. We highlighted the good, we looked at some of the bad, and again, you try to be objective about it. And this loss, and the losses that they've had earlier this month, they're not world-ending losses, and they all have their reasons behind them. Now, I'm not going to come in here and excuse them for losing. They should have beaten the Warriors. It's the Warriors. Without Steph and Klay, with running a bunch of G League guys, they should have won. Absolutely. But that doesn't mean that we can't look at some of the qualifying factors and some of the reasons that may have attributed to this loss. And credit to the Warriors. They ran the double team scheme on James Harden to a T, and the Rockets just couldn't execute in the second half. That's what it boiled down to. This game was almost identical to, I'm going to pull back the Toronto game, where James just simply was getting hardcore double teamed for the majority of the game, did not put up his usual, 30 plus points per game, got close, he had what, 28 in this game, something like that? If I could find my mouse, my God, okay. There we go, where's James' box score at? Hit 24, okay. But he also had 11 dimes. And at the end of the day, the execution was there. The Rockets were getting the shots they wanted, and after reviewing the game, after going back and kind of looking at some of the highlights from the game and watching some of the makes and the misses, and the Rockets were getting the shots that they wanted. But look, Harden shot 6 of 10 from behind the arc, okay? 60%. Amazing. James Harden, just doing his thing, right? The rest of the team, 10 of 41 for 24.4%. The only other guy on the team who was actually shooting the ball well was Daniel House. He was 5 of 12 for 41.6%. So if you take away House's 5 of 12 right there, the team shooting drops even further to a really abysmal 5 of 29. 17.2% shooting. I would like anybody anywhere to point me in the direction of a team that is capable of winning a basketball game while having its rotation players shoot an abysmal below 25%, or even worse, the 17% that everybody else shot. A big chunk of that was Westbrook going 0 for 8. So as far as the execution against that James Harden double team, I basically really only have 2 points to hit on, is they absolutely cannot let Westbrook settle for threes. And part of that was they didn't scheme it properly. They didn't execute it properly when they had Westbrook sitting in the corner. Westbrook has to be right there on the shoulder, and he has to be the guy who attacks the 4-on-3. And it really does fall on Westbrook's shoulders. It falls on him. It falls on Austin Rivers. It will fall on Eric Gordon when he gets back. It falls on your secondary playmakers to make the right read. And then the second part of this is that your shooters have to hit shots. And I hate when it boils down to that. I hate when the analysis just boils down to, if you don't hit shots, you're not going to win the game. But that's exactly what this was. Now, the defensive intensity and the defense kind of did falter in the second half, and especially there in the fourth quarter. They came back, and off that James Harden three, they were up 97-96. So you had a chance at that point to get yourself back into the game, but your offense continued to struggle and you couldn't get stops. And nobody's going to win in the NBA. If your offense falters and if your defense struggles, then you're just not going to win any games. Like, I'm sorry, that's just facts. But this Rockets team has the second highest rated offense in the NBA for a reason. And you just had a night where all of your guys were just absolutely pitiful from behind the arc. So you're just not going to win that way. And it's ridiculous to request that the Rockets, at halftime or going into the fourth quarter, suddenly change their entire team dynamic, the dynamic that has gotten them to 21 and now 21 and 10 on the season. It's ridiculous to expect them to change their entire identity as a team in the middle of a game. I do have a caveat to that, to say that it would be nice if they did have more of a fail-safe move. And this is where, I hate to say it again, this is where you miss the Chris Paul mid-range. This is where you miss that calming hand, that steady, consistent scoring option where, hey, you really need one or two buckets, I got you. It doesn't feel like that exists anywhere in this current team. It doesn't feel like James can get you a bucket when you need it, and it doesn't feel like Russ can get you a bucket when you need it. Now, Russ can get to the hole, and he can attempt a layup, but some of those layups are very hit and miss. So he can get to the hole at will, sure, and he can get a wide open you know, elevated MIDI, but the percentages just aren't there. They're not in his favor. Same thing for James. If he's getting double teamed the entire game, then he can't exactly get a clean look off. And even when he's playing one-on-one at that point, by the end of the game, he's usually pretty gassed. And the percentages, even though he shoots a really nice percentage from three using his, you know, famous step back, the step back that we all know and love, that's still not as high a percentage shot as, you know, a Chris Paul mid-range jumper. I'm sorry. They just don't have that safety valve. They can't throw it in the post to Clint Capella. PJ Tucker can't create off the dribble. There isn't that one go-to move. They don't have that one little spot where it says, we really need a basket right now. We need something to stop the bleeding right now. It's basically all threes, layups, and dunks. And if you're not executing out of that 4v3 properly, and if you're just not hitting your shots, then you're not going to have a chance to win the game. We'll keep breaking this thing down, and I feel like I came off a little strong right there in that first segment, but it was a frustrating game for a lot of reasons, but it's not the end of the world, and that I want to be the takeaway from this overall episode, is it is not the end of the world. I'm not going to sugarcoat anything. I think it's become very clear in the short little while that I've taken over this pod that I don't sugarcoat things. When there's a bad loss, we're going to talk about the problems from the bad loss, but we're not going to sit here and say that the Rockets should blow it up or that Westbrook was a mistake or all these different things. No. We're going to talk about the issues that they have. We're going to talk about some of the solutions moving forward. So don't go anywhere. And we are back in here at Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast home for everything Houston Rockets basketball. Regrettably talking about the Rockets' 116-104 loss against the Golden State Warriors, dropping them to 21-10 on the season. Warriors improving to 8-24, still headed for the number one pick in the lottery. But look, one of the first things that I want to get to in this segment is, and something that I've noticed, and we talk a lot about the defensive struggles of this team, absolutely. And for good reason. They do have defensive struggles. So on a night where your offense just isn't clicking, where the shots just are not falling, this is where the teams that do pride themselves on their defense can still manage to try and win a game. Again, when you fought and you clawed your way back into it, you have the lead, you're up 97-96, and from that point on, you probably only needed to score a few more buckets to kind of get a little bit of separation, and then you just have to get some stops on the other end. And they just couldn't do that. And going back and looking at some of these highlights and, you know, rewatching some of this stuff, it's great. We can pride James on his post defense all we want. We can point that out and say, you know, look at the numbers, say he's one of the best, if not the best post defender in the NBA. Sure. And they do switch a lot. And so when James is in the post, he does absolutely do his job well guarding opposing bigs. But his perimeter defense, along with Russell Westbrook, it is some of the worst that I have ever seen in the league. It's frustrating. It is really frustrating at times. And it's fine usually because they usually have Clint Capella, who is explosive, who's athletic, who is the defensive anchor for this team. But Clint Capella did not look like himself out there. Clint looked a bit labored. That heel is definitely bothering him. We don't know the severity of it. He's obviously playing through it. And there's the old adage that you can play through pain, but you can't play through injury. And so players have to get accustomed to knowing what the difference is between playing through pain and playing through injury. So maybe Capella's just playing through a bit of pain, a bit of discomfort in that heel. But whatever it is he looks a step slow. He doesn't quite look like he has the bounce that he normally does. And so seeing these possessions where there's a ball handler out on the perimeter, and this isn't even like off-ball defense where, you know, lack of awareness or anything like that, because even with those, it feels like James has cut down significantly on those moments where he just loses his defender ball watching or whatever. But his on-the-ball defense, along with Russ down the line there, they just let these guys drive to the rim. And then you've got Capella, who has to rotate over, and then the ball handler gets to make the decision whether they're going to pass to the big or continue to go for a layup. And just watching some of the highlights there in the fourth quarter as the Warriors kind of pushed away, seeing some of the plays where you know, James or Russ, they're not fighting over these picks, or they're not doing a true switch, and they're just kind of, they almost hang back for a minute and kind of expect Capella to just handle both offensive players. And that's an unfair burden for Clint Capella to have to shoulder, to be expected to just be the stopper, where, James is going to lazily reach for the ball, or Russ is going to, you know, kind of get bounced off by the offensive player and then not, you know, make any attempt to recover and get back into the play. And it starts with those two. As your perimeter defenders, those two guys have to have some semblance of want to try and keep guys from getting into the lane and getting these easy looks, and then therefore setting up easy looks for the rest of the team. Because it's just a domino effect. If you let the ball handler drive in easily, all willy-nilly, no effort right there, then even if they penetrate, and maybe they don't get a layup, but then they kick it back out, and then that's when the rotations start, and then suddenly you're going to give up a wide-open three or another wide-open shot off of a good pass somewhere. So the initial effort on the perimeter defense just needs to be a bit better. Again, if you guys don't believe me, y'all can go pull up YouTube and look at the Rockets-Warriors highlights and watch, you know, fast forward to the fourth quarter, and there's just a few possessions where D'Angelo Russell against, I think, both Russ and Harden just gets these super clean drives to the basket, and it feels like the Rockets never get those clean drives. Feels like they never get to just walk it into the paint. It feels like they work hard for everything that they put up there. So not only did you have a night where your offense wasn't clicking, but defensively, we know the defensive problems this team has had. The silver lining is that overall, I mean, looking at the Warriors, they didn't perform exceptionally on offense. They really didn't. They just outworked the Rockets. And look, the Clippers, who are being touted as, you know, legitimate championship contenders and who are, you know, the national media is all over them, right? The Clippers just had one of these types of games recently against the Bulls. You know, they were on the end of a long road trip and they just didn't have the energy to finish off the game. And that's kind of what this game felt like. Because again, if you look at this game and if your shooters actually shoot their regular percentages, if you don't just have a horrid shooting night, you're in this game. You suddenly don't have a lead that's disappearing from under you because you don't have a stretch where you know, for 2-3 minutes where you don't score the ball in the fourth. I think it was about 2 or 3 minutes of an offensive drought during that 97. They took over 96, 97, and then they just didn't score again for about 2-3 minutes, something like that. So if any of your shooters, you know, are in this game and not struggling, then suddenly you're walking away with a win. That's also why getting Eric Gordon back will be nice, because not only does Eric Gordon provide you some of that missed shooting, but he also gives you another guy who can actually create for himself and take the ball off the dribble and get to the rim and finish at the rim. And that's a dynamic that this current squad really doesn't have, because look, Daniel House drives sometimes, but he doesn't usually drive to finish unless it's, you know, kind of a clean lane or a wide open driving lane. He's not going to beat somebody clean off the dribble and then finish over or around a big, at least not consistently. Westbrook and Harden can do that. Rivers can do it a little bit, but his is significantly more finesse. And it feels like even though he's capable of doing it, there's something different about Eric Gordon. When Eric Gordon drives, he's looking to get in there, receive contact, and his ability to finish around the rim is pretty underrated. We think of Eric Gordon as this streaky three-point specialist, but we forget just how capable he is when it comes to driving to the rim. Now, when he starts trying to do other things, when he starts trying to facilitate the ball, and his handles can get a little sloppy, and it becomes, you know, a bit, he becomes a bit turnover prone at times. But when he's just got one mission, no pun intended, when his one mission is to just drive to the rack, he's usually pretty successful. So again, I don't want to walk out of here, I don't want anybody to listen to this and then walk away feeling doom and gloom about this team. There were frustrating issues from this game. And again, it's frustrating because it happens in front of a national audience against a team that you should have beaten. Should have beaten the Golden State Warriors, absolutely. but it comes at the end of a long road trip. And on a road trip where you thought you might go 3-1, most people would have assumed the one loss would have been against the Clippers, but you come away with a win right there. And so your one loss is a frustrating loss against the Warriors, and we'll kind of break down some of the other frustrating losses from earlier this month and give a bit of context behind them, because again, I think it's important to kind of contextualize things and look at things through a wider lens rather than just focusing on this one game and saying, oh, we hate the Rockets, they're frustrating, they're inconsistent. No, we can look at things on a bigger scale. It's a long season. It's 82 games long. This is just game 31. There's time to fix things, and there's time to address the problems at hand. And we'll keep talking in our final segment, so don't go anywhere. All right, and we are here for our last segment at Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast home for everything Houston Rockets basketball, talking about the Rockets' disappointing Christmas loss against the Golden State Warriors. And I've got three more points that I want to hit on in this final segment. The first of which, I'll start kind of in the, I'll do escalating order. First of which is, I really am frustrated with D'Antoni that we didn't give Clemens a chance on a night where it seemed like nobody could hit anything from behind the arc. Clemens has shown that he's not a complete defensive liability. And on top of that, besides that, you can hide Chris Clemens the same way that you try to hide James or Russ on the offensive players that don't matter, or the same way that Golden State tries to hide Steph Curry. You can hide bad defenders. And Clemens hasn't shown to be a bad defender. He does have a bit of a physical disadvantage standing at a towering 5'9". So that can be abused sometimes, especially in the Rockets switching defense. But on a night where nobody could shoot, plug him in. Let him be a spark plug off the bench. Give him a shot. Literally, give him a shot, because he might actually hit it compared to the other guys who were shooting a combined, what was it? Hang on, rest of team. 24%. There we go. Minus house, 17% from behind the arc. Sorry, my notes are everywhere right now. So there's that. So I'm a little upset that Clemens didn't get any burn in a game like that where you need just a little bit of a spark off the bench. It makes sense to give him just a few minutes, see if he can catch fire. And if he doesn't catch fire, then great, plug somebody else back in. But give him a shot. Past that, there was this video circulating on Twitter last night, and it basically highlighted the fact that James Harden walked up on one play in the second half. I think it was in the fourth quarter, in fact, maybe third quarter. But James walked up and he basically made it past the half court margin and then just kind of stood there the entire possession. So the Rockets were essentially playing 4-on-4, although a lot of the people that were quote tweeting this and commenting on it were complaining that James was letting the team play 4-on-5. And I'm torn. I'm actually torn about this video, because there are plays, and Russ does this too, where one of them will just, they take an offensive possession off. And that's fine. The Rockets have four other players on the court for a reason. I take exception to it because he essentially wasn't letting them play 4-on-5, because he has, and I'm not going to say, oh, his gravity is important. You know, it's that is kind of the situation, though, because if you go back and look at the video, James is standing near the half-court margin, and his defender is well out past the three-point line, worried about James catching the ball. So in a way, he was allowing the Rockets to play 4-on-4 for that one possession, and they wound up getting a wide-open Daniel House 3 out of it. So I don't know why anybody's upset by this video. The only other part of it that bothers me is that I still don't think that the best option for beating this trapping, double-teaming defense that James has faced on a number of occasions now, I don't think the best solution is to literally not let him touch the ball. Or I don't think the best solution is to have him just bring the ball up and then immediately dish it and have them play 4v3. Any possession that ends without James shooting the ball is not an ideal possession for the Houston Rockets. He's your best player for a reason. He's averaging damn near 40 a game for a reason. Anytime that he doesn't get to shoot the ball, it's not a great thing for the Rockets. And anytime he's not involved in the play, apart from just bringing the ball up the court, it's not a great thing for the Rockets. So relying on the rest of your team, yes, there's an expectation there that they should be able to execute properly on a 4v3 after the double team on James and get a good look. But I'd really enjoy it if, and this is a thing that has to come from not just D'Antoni, but James has to be willing to do this. I'd really like them to find a way, any way, to just kind of get away from the double team without him bringing the ball up. Whether that's let somebody else bring the ball up and have James run a little bit of action off ball, even if it's just to get him off a quick, you know, get him on a curl off of a quick screen and have him going downhill towards the basket, something. Just he doesn't have to start with the ball in his hands and he doesn't have to bring the ball up the court to allow the double team to hit. Or he doesn't have to catch the ball and spend 5 or 10 seconds in his triple threat position trying to analyze the whole defense. He can make his decisions quicker. He can catch the ball and just go rather than catching the ball and trying to pick apart the defense and decide what he's going to do, whether it's, you know, lulling his defender to sleep with a dribble, dribbling out the shot, whatever it may be. James can get into his actions quicker to then prevent the double team. And we see that sometimes. We see him sometimes ring the ball up the court, and as soon as the double shows its face, he tries to split the double or he'll, you know, go around it, whatever. But I think that when you're letting him bring the ball up the court every single time, it's allowing defenses an easier opportunity to target him with the double team. So this is something that falls on the shoulders of Mike D'Antoni as the coach to draw something up different. And it also falls on Harden and his willingness to do something off the ball. And those are two that might be a stretch to ask for both of them. But at this point, it seems the only solution to the double team is literally play 4v3 and hope that your team can hit shots. And I don't like the idea of James sitting back and basically being a hockey assist man in this offense. He is much more than that. But if the defense keeps playing him that way, then he's going to have to find a way to get around it. And I think that at the end, they've got to find a way to get him shots. In this game, he only scored 24 points, and he only had 18 shot attempts. Again, he was 6 of 10 from behind the arc. There's a reason that he shoots so well. He is your best player. He's your best shooter. He's your best scorer. So having him literally just not involved in the play, 11 assists is fine. That's great. But you look what happened. They lost the game because other people just couldn't hit shots. So that was my second point. My final point, and I've mentioned this before, that I'm not super big on conspiracies, especially in regards to the NBA. Now, if we're talking, you know, like murder conspiracies and stuff, then sign me up. But ever since the Rockets have filed, or ever since the Rockets filed for the protest concerning the dunk that was not in the Spurs game, the Rockets, well, specifically, James Harden was averaging 14.6 free throw attempts in the 20 or so games before the protest. And he's only averaging 7.8 free throw attempts after the protest. Now, this has become a decent sample size because we're in about, again, 20 games before the protest, almost about 10 games after the protest, 9 or 10 games. And those numbers mean something. That is quite literally almost half the free throw attempts that he's used to getting. And it came after the Rockets filed the protest. And the Rockets have had a history with the referees. They've had a history with leaking the unbalanced calls from the Golden State Warriors series. They had the issue now with the Rockets protesting the Spurs game. And then not necessarily a referee issue, but the whole Daryl Morey geopolitical crisis with China, that may as well be playing its hand in this free throw discrepancy for James Harden. So, again, I don't like to say conspiracy, but it's just there's a lot of evidence there that shows that the Rockets are receiving a less favorable whistle ever since filing the protest, specifically James Harden. And the fact that he's still able to go out there and do what he does without getting his usual foul calls is amazing. And I don't know if there's a way to fix this. Because we Rockets fans can make as much noise as we want, but if the NBA doesn't care, if the NBA has a hidden agenda about how they're going to referee James Harden, then there's not much we can do about it other than grit our teeth and bear it and hope that maybe it changes itself over the course of the season. Because again, I don't think it's coincidence that after the protest, his free throw attempts just suddenly dropped. I think it's got more to it than that. And for a guy who, you know, carries the weight of the offense, the free throws are a huge part for him because, again, he is a tank. He carries the entire offense. So getting him a chance to get to the free throw line, get a breather, and score some easy points is amazing. This was the first game since, I want to say it was Jonathan Fagan sent out the information, but I think this is the first game that James Harden has not made a single free throw. He was 0 for 1 since March of last year. It was like March of last year against the T-Wolves that Harden didn't hit a single free throw. And for a guy who's used to averaging close to, you know, 13 makes a game, for him to not have a single free throw, or for him to only have one free throw attempt and to have zero makes over the course of an entire game, it's ridiculous. So I'm not painting, you know what, no, we're going to say conspiracy. It's a conspiracy. The NBA hates James Harden and the Rockets. And that's not the reason that you lost this game. It's not. I'm not trying to make an excuse. You lost this game because you just didn't play to the best of your ability. And that's what it boils down to. Rockets not named James Harden and Daniel House kind of let the team down a little bit. Westbrook, I'm on the fence with him for this game. The 0 of 8 from behind the arc was painful. It really was. But if you take all those three-pointers away, he was 11 of 24. So he was doing exactly what he needed to do otherwise. He had 12 rebounds, 5 assists, just 4 turnovers, which in my mind is a good mark for Westbrook. 4, maybe 5 turnovers a game is acceptable for him. So really, and he was 8 of 8 at the foul line. So he was doing what he needed to do apart from all the threes that he was taking, which were kind of, he was forced into taking them because of the James Harden double teams. And because the Rockets didn't do a good job executing out of those double teams, putting the players in the spots that they needed to be in order to succeed. And part of that comes from, and I mentioned it earlier, leaving Westbrook in the corner. If you put Westbrook in the corner, he's almost bound to have to shoot the ball. But there were other opportunities or other areas that he did shoot the ball where he wasn't just being forced to shoot the ball. So some of that is the decision-making on his part. And I even mentioned that before. When he went 3 of 4, was it last game? Yeah, last game when he went 3 of 4 from downtown. There's a worry that he's going to take that and take that confidence into the next game. And we don't want that. It was great that he shot 3 of 4 from behind the arc. But now we see what happened. He goes 0 for 8. Pretty sure I called that in the last pod, which is frustrating. But anyways, my main takeaway and everybody's main takeaway from this game should be that bad losses do happen. That does not mean that you ignore what happens in the bad losses. You still look at it, talk about it, hopefully come up with a solution to the issues in said loss. But it's also not the end of the world. It's a game in December. This is a long season. It's game 31 of 82. They've got time to figure themselves out. They've got time to figure out the execution against this newfangled defense that James is facing seemingly every other night. They've got time to get Eric Gordon back healthy and get him integrated into the roster. Zone Buster Eric Gordon, maybe we'll call him Double Team Buster Eric Gordon, because having both Eric Gordon and Russell Westbrook on the court facing this double team, imagine having both of those guys on the shoulders with James Harden being double teamed right at the top of the key. It's going to be really hard for defenses to figure that one out. Right now, the Rockets don't have that luxury. So again, getting him back will be huge. And overall, this team is too talented to not get it figured out. So I'm still holding out hope. I'm not sugarcoating anything. It was a frustrating loss, but I'm holding out hope. I think that's where we'll break things off for today. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. If you want more content before our next show, social media is where it's all happening. I'm on there, at JT Gatlin, and of course the show is on there, at Locked On Rockets. Past that, there's Facebook, which can be found at facebook.com/LockedOnRockets, the website, LockedOnRockets.com, and our email address, LockedOnRockets@gmail.com. All of these are different ways to consume content about your Houston Rockets. You can ask me questions about the team, make suggestions for the show, place advertising inquiries. Really, it's just a way for you guys to reach out to me and let me know if there's anything that we can do to improve this experience for you, our listeners. Beyond that, if you'd be kind enough to subscribe and rate the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Himalaya, wherever it is that you listen to your podcasts, if you could please subscribe and give us a 5-star review. That's how you get the benefit of episodes that go straight to your inbox before they show up on the previously mentioned social media outlets, and we get the benefit of looking attractive to potential advertisers and keeping this business model rolling along as the most regular podcast covering Houston Rockets basketball. Again, for this December 26th, day after Christmas episode, this is where we break. As always, thank you so much for listening, and we hope to have you back again very, very soon right here at Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast home for everything Houston Rockets basketball.